Valtava from Marvlas by Smetana, played by the Prague Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Libor Pešek. Thanks for joining me. I will be back next week at 9. Sunday morning's a tandem production for BBC Radio 3. On FM, on digital and on your smart speaker. This is Radio 3. It's midday and time for the news, read by Andrew Peach.
The Home Secretary James Cleverly has said young people won't be compelled to join the military under the Conservatives' plan to bring back a form of mandatory national service if it wins the general election. The scheme would see 18-year-olds join the service for a year or volunteer one weekend every month in the community. Mr. Cleverly told the BBC the plan would tackle social fragmentation and get young people out of their bubble. The Shadow Chancellor Rachel Reeves has said Labour wouldn't raise income tax or national insurance if it was elected, but she wouldn't rule out some spending cuts. Ms. Reeves said the party would be faced with difficult decisions. Aid trucks from Egypt are reported to have begun to enter the Gaza Strip through the Kerem Shalom border crossing. A senior official of the Egyptian Red Crescent Society said about 200 vehicles were expected to cross the border, including four fuel trucks. Earlier, Israel rejected a claim by Hamas that one of its soldiers had been captured in northern Gaza. The United Nations says it fears 670 people have died after a landslide in Papua New Guinea. The disaster happened on Friday, and so far only a handful of bodies have been recovered. The relief effort is being hampered by a lack of heavy machinery, with rescuers using basic tools like shovels. A fire at a children's hospital in the Indian capital Delhi has killed at least six babies. Several other newborns are receiving treatment after being rescued from the burning building. The cause of the fire isn't yet clear. Delhi's chief minister described the incident as heartbreaking. Mexico City has recorded its highest ever temperature during the latest in a series of heat waves. The temperature in the Mexican capital reached 34.7 degrees yesterday, breaking the previous record set earlier this month. 48 people have died nationwide since March due to intense heat waves. The weather here, a Met Office yellow warning has been issued because of thunderstorms due to hit large parts of England, Wales and southern Scotland later. Forecasters say more than an inch of rain could fall in an hour and there could also be hail and lightning strikes. Top temperatures of 18 in London, 16 in Cardiff and Belfast and 14 in Edinburgh. That's the BBC News and Weather at 2 minutes past 12. Next, Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
Music Matters on BBC Radio 3.
I'm Clemency Burton-Hill, and in the winter of 2008, I was invited to be a member of the West Eastern Divan Orchestra, the brainchild of Edward Said and Daniel Barenboim.
This is the miracle of music and what music means.
Where Arab and Israeli young people come together to make music. In this series, we're going to trace the story of the Divan from its roots right up to the present day.
25 years of the West Eastern Divan Orchestra. Listen to the first episode now on BBC Sounds.
Imtiaz Darker was awarded the Queen's Gold Medal for Poetry in 2014, and she's published seven collections of her verse. She's performed her poems to thousands of students at poetry live events, a scheme founded by her late husband, Simon Rees-Powell. Imtiaz was born in Lahore in Pakistan and was 6 months old when her family moved to Glasgow. There she grew up as, in her words, a Muslim Calvinist. There's a poem in there, I think. When she was 17, Imtiaz fell in love with her first husband, married in secret, and eloped to India. As a result, she was disowned by her family, but began to publish her first poems. She illustrates all her collections with beautiful black and white ink drawings. Now, you've brought us a rich tapestry of music today, Imtiaz. Rimsky-Korsakov, Max Richter, Chopin, Messiaen, but why are we starting with Dvorak?
Well, because this is the song to the moon. And I do love anything to do with the moon. I think I own the moon. I think most poets probably do feel like that. And the words in this, you travel around the world and look into people's houses. Moon, stand still a while and tell me where my love is. You know, how many of us have felt like that across time? There's something really moving about the idea that people separated by time and geography still look at the same moon.
It's a wonderful song, beautifully written, and it was wonderfully sung there, I thought, by Lucia Popp.
I think so, absolutely. And on top of this, of course, there's the pathos of knowing that when she becomes human, Rusalka is going to lose her voice. Another thing I want to say about why this song is one of my favourites is that I know a lot of poets and we all watch the moon. We're all moon watchers. So when we sight a full moon or a new moon, we send each other messages on our phones.
You start to howl. Well, accompanying Lucia Popp in Dvořák's Song to the Moon from his opera Rusalka was the Munich Radio Orchestra, conducted by Stefan Soltes. Coincidentally, Imtiaz, it was an Englishman, I think, in Lahore called Mr. Moon who was responsible for your dad coming to the UK?
There was, yes. He took him under his wing. My father was the son of the Chaudhry in a kind of rural place, and he was going to be working with the land and agriculture. But Mr. Moon decided that this was a very bright young man, and he said, you have to send him to the school in Lahore. And my grandfather apparently went to the school to see if it was good enough for his son.
So you grew up as a result in Glasgow, and you've described yourself, as I said, as a wonderful term, Muslim Calvinist. What do you mean by that when you say it?
I actually said I'm a Scottish Pakistani Muslim Calvinist who grew up in Glasgow, was adopted by India and married into Wales. Now, why did I say that? It's because what I'm really saying is don't put me in a box. We're all multiple things, every one of us, under the skin. We all have possibilities and layers which you can't see at first sight.
So your dad built up a business from scratch, more or less. He started out as a door-to-door salesman, but ended up selling sports equipment.
Yes.
And your mum was something of a homemaker?
She was. She loved making things with her hands. She was brilliant at so many things.
Must be so strange coming to Glasgow. Did your mum embrace life there?
Oh, she did. She had friends and she loved dressing up. She had this wonderful purple velvet hat and she'd go out in her stilettos and take us out to tea in Lewis's on Argyle Street, where she would tell us how to use a knife and fork. You know, I don't know where and how this all worked out, but I loved those teas.
And Sundays would be spent with your extended family.
Yes, up in the Campsie Fells outside Glasgow, or Loch Lomond.
You wrote about this in your poem Campsie Fells, where there are some really lovely lines about your mum. My mother settled like a queen, a sculpture, took possession of that field, spread all her goods around her. That sounds like a picnic, doesn't it?
Yes, it was. My mother's cooking was marvellous, of course. There was something about her. Whenever she cooked, she could feed multitudes. There would always be guests turning up and she would always be ready to feed them.
I love the idea of making crab apples into green chutney, making the most of what you've got.
Well, she took those crab apples and she turned her homesickness into green chutney. But of course, she was really inventive and she'd find ways to recreate the dishes, the rasgullas and the gulab jamuns from home. She'd find all kinds of strange ingredients to make that happen.
Did music play a role in your family?
Absolutely, because on Sundays we would bring out the big grundig, the TK-30. If you remember it, those are like big grey elephant. And they would be reel to reel. I don't know where they got them from, but they would bring in music from Hindustani films. We didn't call it Bollywood then, but Hindustani films. And there would be films from the 50s, which they loved, because I think those songs were very special. They were based on poems by Urdu poets.
Are you going to give us an example of the sort of thing you loved and listened to?
Well, there was Ye Mailon, Ye Takhton, Ye Tajon Ki Dunya from the film Piyasa in 1957. And the poet who wrote it was Sahir Ludhianvi, and it's sung by Muhammad Rafi.
And it's translated as, so what if I gain the universe?
Well, it translates these palaces, these thrones, these crowns the world worships, keep it. it's yours, I don't want it. You know, it's a story of a poet battling against a corrupt world. And in the film, a publisher rejects his work and tells him, write about poetic things like the the arch of an eyebrow or roses or nightingales. And of course, the poet in this film, played by the great actor Gurudatt, would have none of that.
ये महलों ये तख्तों ये ताजों की दुनिया ये इंसान के दुश्मन समाजों की दुनिया ये दौलत के भूखे रवाजों की दुनिया ये दुनिया अगर मिल भी जाए तो क्या है ये दुनिया अगर मिल भी जाए तो क्या है हर एक जिस्म घायल हर एक रूह प्यासी निगाहों में उलझन दिलों में उदासी ये दुनिया है या आलमे बद हवासी ये दुनिया अगर मिल भी जाए तो क्या है ये दुनिया अगर मिल भी जाए तो क्या है यहाँ एक खिलौना है इंसान की हस्ती ये बसती है मुर्दा परस्तों की बसती यहाँ पर तो जीवन से है मौत सस्ती ये दुनिया अगर मिल भी जाए तो क्या है ये दुनिया अगर मिल भी जाए तो क्या है जवानी भटकती है बदकार बनकर जवान जिस्म सजते हैं बाजार बनकर यहाँ प्यार होता है व्यापार बनकर ये दुनिया अगर मिल भी जाए तो क्या है ये दुनिया अगर मिल भी जाए तो क्या है ये दुनिया जहाँ आदमी कुछ नहीं है वफा कुछ नहीं दोस्ती कुछ नहीं है ये दुनिया जहाँ आदमी कुछ नहीं है वफा कुछ नहीं दोस्ती कुछ नहीं है जहाँ प्यार की कद्र ही कुछ नहीं है ये दुनिया अगर मिल भी जाए तो क्या है ये दुनिया अगर मिल भी जाए तो क्या है
There's a great climactic scene which you see, especially at the end of that song, in an auditorium full of people who think he's dead. And he sings this song, which is really a kind of a protest against society and the kind of society that this poet, Sair Ludhianvi, felt he was working in. He was part of the Progressive Writers Association, which believed in bringing about social change through art. And that ending is, burn it down, raise it to the ground.
You and I were chuckling to each other as it grew in intensity and the strings were going absolutely mad, weren't they?
That's right. There's no shortage of drama in this.
And we heard Mohammed Rafi.
That's right.
The 1957 Hindi film Pyaasa. When, Imtiaz Darker, did you first become aware of poetry?
Well, strangely enough, it was listening to songs like this when I realized that actually these were poems. I think young people especially react to the song. And when I realized that these were actually poets who were writing these songs, and Sair Ludhianvi was someone that my parents would quote, and they would say lines of poems and answer each other with poetry, and they would cry and feel great emotion. I thought, this poetry thing is really, really powerful. Maybe I should think about doing some of it. And that's when I really began to write. I wrote my first poem when I was about 10 or 11.
There was a romantic element to one of your very first poems, wasn't there?
Well, I've written a poem looking back at that when I was much older. I looked out from my own window to the window of a little boy across the street, and he'd be there with his little moon face and he'd be doing exercises in his window. He was very young, but I was younger, and I never knew his name. I was in love with him. He never knew anything about this, never spoke to me. I never spoke to him. But the poem I wrote, I was answered back by other poets, by Shakespeare and John Donne and Robert Burns.
Actually, I was going to ask you if there was something of a gulf between your life at home and the world outside.
Yes, of course. I've said walking out of the front door is like crossing over to another country. The language changes, everything changes. And that, I think, is true for everyone who has two languages or even two accents. One at home and one outside. It doesn't even happen knowingly. It's just that you adapt and switch. But yes, it was, I'd say, another country. But I felt that I could bridge the two. I felt I could bridge many cultures and encompass them.
So was writing to a certain extent a means of travelling in your mind?
Yes, I think so. Writing doesn't have any borderlines. Poetry goes without a passport. It's something that is a kind of freedom. A white space on the page can be anything. And within that, you can be anyone and do anything you want.
I'm getting the impression, Imtiaz, that storytelling lies behind a lot of the things that you love. We've had Rusalka, and now we're going to hear something from Scheherazade, aren't we?
Yes, another great story. And it was the very first Western classical music I ever heard. And again, the technology matters a little, because I was only about 10 and my sister and I had this little pink plastic turntable which played at two speeds, 33 and 45. And you had to pull the arm to start the turntable. But we played it over and over because she was learning to play the violin. But also the reason it had caught our attention was the whole story of Scheherazade, the 1001 Nights, you know, stories within stories. And we saw some connection to that, I think. It was something we really loved.
Thank you. The Legend of the Calendar Prince from Scheherazade by Rimsky-Korsakov, performed by the Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Lorin Marzel. It's wonderfully descriptive music, isn't
it? Yes, it has a story.
Imtiaz Darke, you went on to study English literature and philosophy at Glasgow University, and it was there that you met the man who would become your first husband, the journalist Anil Darke. Was it an intellectual attraction, a physical attraction, a combination of both?
Everything. When you're 17, how can it be one thing?
And tell me a little bit about the proposal, which I think was somewhat unusual.
Well, I was wearing black. He arrived back from India and he called for me on the tannoy at the Students' Union, and I came down not knowing who was going to be there. And he had got a sheriff's dispensation to be married. I had no idea this was going to happen. And we went off to get married with me dressed in black and witnesses who were lecturers at the university.
So you were secretly married, in fact.
Yes.
Why was that necessary?
He was Hindu. I was Muslim. He was Indian. I'd been born in Pakistan. And my parents would have disapproved of this.
So you eloped to Mumbai.
I did.
In 1970. That's rather romantic and exciting in itself.
Well, it felt at the time like something that had to be done. It wasn't so much romantic as, running away doesn't feel romantic when it's happening. It's full of all kinds of other emotions as well.
So when you were leaving that night, you must have felt a bit torn.
I did.
And did that have repercussions for you?
Well, I never saw my mother again, just because I was in another country, I wasn't coming back, and she died before I ever got a chance to see her again. I did see my father, and eventually we began to, with time, rediscover each other and discover that we could talk and we had a lot in common.
But not seeing your mum again, that must have been quite difficult.
It was.
Because you clearly
dreadful. Loved
her.
It was terrible.
Do you feel great regret about that? Would you have done things differently? Or maybe you feel you did the right thing?
No, I would have done everything exactly as I did.
Music by Chopin next.
The Nocturnes. When I went to Bombay, it was a huge sensual overload for me. And every day I'd feel as if I was being knocked off balance and hanging on by my fingernails. But at night, I'd come home and sit in the dark and put on the Nocturnes played by Rubinstein. And even in Bombay, in the middle of chaos, this music gave me a kind of still space. The notes are so crystal and precise and perfect. I felt as if it changed my breathing and made a kind of clearing in the heart. And wherever I am in the world now, this music instantly calms me and gives me a space to think and write in.
Thank you.
He does a wonderful leap in the middle of that melody. He goes up a third and an octave. That moment catches one, doesn't it?
Well, I don't know the musical craft of how he did it, but to me that stillness, that moment of suspense but stillness at the same time is what poetry does too. And, you know, in that moment of writing, often in the middle of the night when time stands still, in a way that's what he's doing with the music.
One of the most striking things, I think, about your poetry books is that they're strewn with your black and white drawings and designs. Is that quite an important part for you to actually illustrate these yourself?
Yes, I find that when I'm writing or even walking around a city, I carry sheets of paper and pens always, and sometimes what can come out of it can be a poem and other times it can be a drawing. It's just something I've always done.
So that's interesting. It's almost like having two languages.
It could be either, but usually, even in the poetry, very often it comes from an image. I see one as flowing into the other. In fact, someone used another lovely word, which is amplification. So it's almost as if one expands, one breathes into the other.
It's the natural world and music coming together next, because we've got a cellist, the famous cellist Beatrice Harrison from the 1920s. Why this particular recording?
Well, as you know, Beatrice was a cellist who practiced playing in the garden. And one night, a nightingale started singing, answering back to the cello, and then the next night and the next, this went on. And she managed to persuade the BBC to broadcast it. As you know, John Reith at the BBC wasn't keen at first because he said the birds would act like prima donnas and wouldn't, might not actually perform. But they did actually do a test, the engineers, and she first played, in fact, Rimsky-Korsakov, Jean Hindou, and then Dvorak's songs My Mother Taught Me, and then Danny Boy.
It was actually the first ever live BBC Outside broadcast, and certainly the first ever broadcast of a wild bird song.
Yes, and it was a genuine bird singing. I have to say this. There was no facility at that time for anyone to play around with the recordings.
It's such a lovely idea, isn't it? Yes. A cello accompanying a nightingale, or the other way around.
It is. It's like a conversation between art and nature. The cello speaking to a nightingale and the nightingale having a conversation back with the cello.
Thank you. It's quite transfixing, isn't it?
It is, absolutely. That birdsong is such pure sound. It must be the dream of every singer or musician or artist to speak and have nature answer back, or even better, to make art that is as pure and uncluttered as birdsong.
Beatrice Harrison performing Dvorak's Songs My Mother Taught Me on the cello, accompanied by the nightingales in her garden, and recorded, amazingly, in 1927. You've actually written, Imtiaz Darker, a beautiful poem involving a bird that sings into the dusk here in the UK, and I wonder if you might read it for us now.
Yes, this is from my new book, Shadow Reader, and it's called Night Walk with Blackbird. Night walk is long as the dark, dark long as the shadow, shadow long as lost gods, gods long gone as gutted words. Because I have walked so many miles alone, because it has been too long since I saw your face, the rings are falling off my fingers, bangles sliding off my wrists. When I come to count the dead, they do not look like numbers. They look like people who were loved, laid with care on hospital beds. Over the long wailing of ambulances, a blackbird begins to sing. And I think, this is what I mean. This is what I was trying to say all along.
Thank you very much. Beautiful. Now, another bird that means a lot to you. And this one reminds you not of an English country garden, but of Mumbai?
Yes, it's the sound of a koel over a busy street in India. And a street in India has a very specific sound. It's not like any other street in any other part of the world. But this beautiful, pure call high above the trees and above the city is something that is quite unique.
What kind of bird is a koel?
It's a kind of cuckoo. And a koel is the sound of longing and the sound of a lover's longing in poetry from that part of the world.
I couldn't help thinking, as we were talking about birdsong, of Olivier Messiaen, who was the composer who, perhaps more than any other, was able to notate birdsong.
Yes, obviously he was obsessed with the bird sound, but you can see why, because birdsong is a first voice in the world.
It's not exactly one of his L'Oiseau Exotique that we're going to hear next, but it is a very famous Messiaen piece, isn't it?
Yes, the Quartet for the End of Time.
Yes, he wrote this when he was a prisoner of war, and it was first performed by prisoners in front of their fellow inmates and guards in 1941.
And what he said about this was, between 3 and 4 in the morning, birds awaken. We know that time. A solo blackbird or nightingale improvises, surrounded by a shimmer of sound. What a lovely thing to say.
Thank you. We heard the Hebrides Ensemble, conducted by William Conway, playing the Crystal Liturgy, the opening of the quartet for the End of Time. But he said something very interesting about the third movement.
Yes, Messiaen in the preface to the third movement said, "The abyss is time with its sadnesses and tediums. The birds are the opposite of time. They are our desire for light, for stars, for rainbows, and for jubilant outpourings of song."
In the early noughties, Imtiaz, your poems ended up on the teaching syllabus in British schools, and that's when you were first contacted by Simon Powell, the founder of Poetry Live. Why did he want to meet you?
Well, he wanted me to come to read at Poetry Live. And he sent a message saying, "Here is a list of 48 events that you could come and read at." And
not much way out of that.
No. And I said, "Well, fine, I'll do 2 weeks." And when I went there, I met this incredible man who was doing these amazing events where poets would read and young people would hear poets at Poetry Live, see that they were live people to begin with, that would take the poems off the page, and you would hear the breath and the accent and the hesitations of a live poet. Now, first of all, that's all very well. It was a great, great thing that he did. But what I saw was this beautiful man, Simon Powell, who was so funny and so unique. And I fell in love with him.
It's a story, really, his story about the time you met him, of both great beauty, inspiration, but also tragedy, because he'd been diagnosed with cancer. But on top of that, his first wife, Sian, who had nursed him through the illness, had just died, leaving him and their three sons. But he had an indomitable spirit.
Absolutely. And he knew what he had to do. I think what he did was he took this idea of an illness, and he would never talk about battling, or he didn't want to talk about it in those terms. It was just something to deal with. He dealt with it like someone who was servicing a motorbike.
The art of motorcycle maintenance.
Yes, I'm going for my servicing, he'd say. And he dealt with that, but he also dealt with great humour. He was able to bring his sons through that time. They were young, of losing their mother and fearing for their father, and do it with daily humour. We laughed so much through that time. And of course, he thought he was in remission at first. We did think he was in remission, and the doctors did give him 10 years of life. I knew him for 7 of those, and I felt I was very lucky.
In 2003, in fact, you returned from India to the UK for good, to be with him.
Yes. Well, I came back thinking I was coming to do some more readings, and he said, "Right, you're not leaving."
The next piece of music.
A Sufi zikr from the Silk Road, Bajmen Tadayon. And a zikr is a way that the Sufis would find a way to make a direct connection with God, a remembrance through the breaths and often through whirling or spinning. So the arms are open, the right arm's lifted to the sky for God's blessing, and the left is towards the earth. And the dancers spin from right to left around the heart.
The whirling dervishes.
Yes, absolutely. It's a way of abandoning the ego, the soul, dancing out of love for God. And of course, what Sufis try to do is include all of humanity and nature in this circle of love. It is a dervish dance. And the music that goes with that is a kind of a use of the breath. You breathe the name of God. Oh. Oh. I said, it uses the human breath in a kind of simple chant. To me, it's almost like a Gregorian chant in some ways. I don't get along with organized religion, but I like sacred music.
It's interesting how sacred music and so many other things in art depend on repetition.
Yes. Well, the rush of our blood, the pulse, the beating of the heart, all of those things, our breath coming in and out, even when we walk, the repetition of our step, those are the basis for poetry and music and so much of art.
The moon and the tides.
The moon, the tides, our human body.
We heard Sufi Zikr, written and performed by the Rome-based Persian musician who's made a speciality of Sufi music and lyrics, Peryaman Tedayon, from his 2017 album, Silk Road. Imtiaz Darker, Simon died in 2009, just 3 years after you'd married, in fact. It must have felt as though you'd been cheated in some ways, although perhaps what you got out of it meant you felt quite the opposite.
Absolutely the opposite. I felt so lucky that I'd had him for the 7 years that I knew him, three of which I was married to him. And I know he felt like that too, that he'd been given a kind of gift of time. He had had the opportunity to meet me. I'd had the opportunity to have him in my life. And it was a great blessing that we'd been together for that time. I would have loved to have him for the whole of the rest of my life, but I was very, very glad that I'd had him for the time I did.
And with somebody like that, in some ways, one does have them for the whole of the rest
Absolutely.
Of your
life. Absolutely. He's still present. He's sitting there smiling at every table I'm at.
One of the ways in which you coped with the grief was your collection of poems, Over the Moon, for which you won the Queen's Gold Medal for Poetry in 2014. It contains several moving poems, but I love the entreaty to live to 101, which begins, be old, be very old, wear bedroom slippers and cardigans, smoke a pipe, grow bald, buy a loaf of bread and count your pennies very slowly at the till. Would he have enjoyed this?
Oh, he would have loved it. He liked a good laugh, and he was always there with his head tilted up, smiling, ray of sunshine. And that's one of the things about Over the Moon. When I began to try and write about Simon, it wasn't working at first because really what I wanted to do was just scream. But finally what I realized was that I wasn't writing grief poems. I was writing love poems. And that there are things that the poem can say which you can't say in any logical way. It's beyond words. What you can get from a poem is beyond logic.
Well, and that's true of music too, isn't
it? Yes, absolutely, of course.
In fact, you took part in our next piece, or in a performance of it, didn't you?
This was Max Richter's Voices. The experience was like nothing I'd ever felt before because I've never been in an orchestra. But suddenly being there in the middle of this kind of swirl of sound, it was like being inside the heartbeat of music with Mary Samuelson on violin and Grace Davidson singing and voices from all over the world in a kind of huge sweep of humanity. And I was reading the Declaration of Human Rights. So it was a huge collective experience for me. And the declaration starts, all human beings are born free and equal in dignity and rights. They are endowed with reason and conscience and should act towards one another in a spirit of brotherhood. I mean, this is something so close. And I did two of those performances, one at Cardiff and one in London. And then they went with Tilda Swinton, who was happy to be the narrator. I can't imagine why they went with her when they had me.
Nor can I. In fact, it's a huge piece, almost an hour long. So here is part of Voices, composed and performed by Max Richter.
Thank you.
Chorale Part 4 from Voices, composed and performed by Max Richter, who was joined by the soprano Grace Davidson, the violinist Mary Samuelson, and the tenor break choir, all conducted by Robert Ziegler. Does that bring back memories of your performing days?
Actually, what it reminds me of is our shared humanity and the way that music can lift you up.
Imtiaz Darker, I was wondering where for you inspiration comes from when you start to write. Is there a preconceived notion of something you want to conjure up?
If I ever have a preconceived notion, my poem is never obedient enough to go along with it. The poems take a route of their own. But really the inspiration is human voices, things going on in the world, everything that I sense and feel around me. Very often I go for a walk. We talked about walking earlier, and you hear halves of conversations going by. And that, you know, the human voice is a great thing for causing a poem.
Your most recent collection, Shadow Reader, begins with the true story of a prophecy, doesn't it?
Yes. In Bombay, I was taken to meet a shadow reader. This is a man who tells your future by measuring your shadow, measures it, does all his calculations, and then reaches up behind him for a scroll, opens it, unscrolls it, and your future is written there, and he reads it out to you. And he told me, when I was only 25, so it was a fair enough thing, he said, you'll live to a really ripe old age. And he told me the year of my death, and that was last year.
Well, I'm so pleased about that.
you're still here.
You're still here. Threads, textiles, the warp and weft are leitmotifs throughout your poetry in this collection. In the poem Face to Face, you ask, can the writer be forgiven by the one who is written? Does the warp look back at the one who is weaving and say, this is not how I remembered it, not how it happened at all?
Well, really, the whole book is about foretelling and telling and retelling the story. So much of what's going on, events, conflicts, how they're reported, is about who's taken charge of the story. And you see that more and more today. Who gets to tell the story? Who takes possession of it or rewrites it? And you just have to look at how history can be distorted or the different ways one event is reported. It's about occupation of so many kinds. So the shadow reader's prediction of the date of my death occupies my mind, even if I don't believe it. And in the same way, the poems slide over from this to the occupation of countries, the earth, the natural world, the way we colonize the natural world and all its creatures.
Do you still feel that the shadow reader had a legitimacy for you, even though he got that wrong?
A lot of other things he said were actually weirdly correct. Now, I don't know if that's because I didn't go to him willingly, I have to say. I was shutting off my mind. I didn't want to be there. I didn't want to believe him. I'm a skeptic. But a few things he said chimed weirdly with what happened in my life. Now, I don't know if that's because looking back, you kind of want things to fit in. There are so many aspects to that. I really, really didn't believe him. But suddenly, when the year approached, and it was COVID, and there were all kinds of things happening then, so I did start writing my will.
And is it the narrative in this wonderful Billie Holiday version of Strange Fruit that attracted you?
Well, yes. I remember when I first heard it, and I love her singing, of course, and I, you know, her version of Blue Moon, I've always loved it, and all the love songs. And I thought I was listening, the very first time I heard it, I was quite young, I thought I was listening to a love song, but suddenly realized what it was about. Southern trees bear strange fruit, blood on the leaves and blood at the root. And then, you know, the terrible line, black bodies swinging in the southern breeze. It was absolutely shocking. The sudden smell of burning flesh. I thought, what is this?
Thank you.
Southern trees bear strange fruit. Blood on the leaves and blood at the root. Black bodies swinging in the southern breeze. Strange fruit hanging from the poplar trees. Pastoral scene of the gallant south, the bulging eyes and the twisted mouth, scent of magnolia, sweet and fresh. Then the sudden smell of burning flesh. Here is a fruit for the crows to pluck, for the rain to gather, for the wind to suck, for the sun to rot, for the tree to drop. Here's a strange and bitter cry.
It's devastating, isn't it?
She sings that with so much control and precision, but that somehow contains the rage, you know, centuries of rage.
Strange Fruit, performed by Billie Holiday and the Tony Scott Orchestra. Tony Scott playing clarinet, Charlie Shavers wailing on the trumpet, Wynton Kelly on the piano. A few years ago, I think you turned down the Poet Laureateship, despite describing it as a huge honour. Why did you feel you should do that?
I was considered for the post of Poet Laureate and stepped aside. I really feel I need the privacy and the time to write poems. I'm not really cut out for huge public spaces and public roles.
Carol Ann Duffy has said that if there were a world laureate, you'd be the only poet who could possibly take on that role. Given the current instability in the world, do you still feel poetry has power, carries weight enough to make people think about what is happening?
I think poetry now more than ever has a place, because this is a time for nuance, for not the heated rhetoric and the weasel words which are used in politics, not for the kind of debased language of politics, but for the nuance that poetry can bring, for the appeal beyond the so-called facts, which we know can always be warped. In fact, this is the time more than ever when poetry is there as witness, and witness of this kind, which is subtle, is more needed than ever.
We talked a bit about repetition in music and in art, and someone who's made a great feature of that, of course, is Philip Glass. This piece is from his string quartet number 3, Mishima. Why this?
Oh, I just like it.
That's a good enough reason.
Yes.
Mishima from the String Quartet No. 3 by Philip Glass, performed by the Kronos Quartet. Imtiaz Darker, happily the shadow reader was wrong, and so here we are. And you mentioned reconciliation with your father. Was that difficult to achieve? Did it happen gradually?
I first met my father 10 years after I'd left. I met him at an airport, and he was coming out, and I went up to him and I said hello, and he said hello and spoke to me as if I was an acquaintance, because I realized later there were two or three factors. One is I had green hair and I didn't look much like the girl who had left home. And second, he had come for a cataract operation, which I didn't know at the time. And so he couldn't actually see who I was. So he spoke to me first as a stranger and then slowly realized who I was. I had to say, I'm Imtiaz, I'm your daughter. And then he came back and hugged me.
Well, that was joyous. But also you're a grandmother now, so that must also bring you quite a lot.
There's nothing like it. And the amazing thing is that in the grandchild, you see elements of all the people who've gone before. Of course, her mother and father, but of course, all the ancestors as well.
Even if it's only shadows of those personalities.
And the shadows are there always, and the shadows are also a kind of celebration.
Lovely note to finish on. Just tell us about your last piece before we reluctantly depart.
Another celebration, Louis Armstrong, La Vie en Rose. I struggled with myself about whether I should have the Piaf or the Louis Armstrong, but there is so much joy in the Louis Armstrong. And for me, it's holidays, it's sunshine, a cliche of a holiday, but I love this song.
Imtiaz Darker, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
The magic spell you cast, this is La Vie en Rose. When you kiss me, heaven sighs, and though I close my eyes, I see La Vie en Rose. When you press me to your heart, and in a world apart, a world where roses bloom. And when you speak, angels sing from above. Everyday void seems to turn into love song. Give your heart and soul to me, and life will always bleed. La Vie en Rose.
Vion Rose, performed by Louis Armstrong, the final choice of Michael Barclay's guest today on Private Passions, the poet Imtiaz Darker. And if you'd like to hear more about Beatrice Harrison duetting with Nightingales, as chosen by Imtiaz, then do listen to last week's Sunday feature, The Cello and the Nightingale, which you can find on BBC Sounds. Private Passions was produced by Claire Walker. And next week, Michael will be talking to Dorothy Byrne, the former head of news at Channel 4.
BBC Radio 3, the home of classical music.
I think one of the great parts of presenting breakfast is that you're helping people launch their day well. If the day starts good, it's much more likely to continue that way. And introducing a great range of good music can really help with that process.
Breakfast with Petrock Trelawney.
You'll hear familiar works for piano and orchestra, string quartet. And at the heart of the programme, works by the great composers, Mozart, Schubert, Bach, Beethoven.
Breakfast with Petrock Trelawney.
Back tomorrow from 6:30. Listen on Radio 3 and BBC Sounds.
It's 1:30 and time to join Sarah Moore-Peach on her Sunday afternoon musical journey, in which she charts musical connections across time and space on the way to a particular musical destination.
Hello and welcome to BBC Radio 3's Music Map. Today, heading for this radiant destination. This is the slow movement of Beethoven's 15th string quartet, one of the most breathtaking expressions of life that I can think of. This slow movement is known as the Heilige Dank